Well, good morning, everybody. Come on in. Welcome to Cedar Creek on this Father's Day. I already told Joel, who's our coordinator this morning, that I am going to go along. So if you're out there, come on in. So I'm just going to warn you all ahead of time. We have been working through this series on saints, scoundrels, and sinners, which has been so far just a lot of fun. You know, we are looking at a bunch of Old Testament characters, and I hope we can learn some from their lives, not only about who they are, but about who God is and about who we are. I think one of the interesting things about fiction stories and biographies is that they teach us a lot about not only the characters, but about us. That's why we're drawn to them, and I think that's why we get drawn to stories like this in our own lives, because it helps us to reflect on who we are. Now, this morning, we're going to talk about Esther, Queen Esther. And, yeah, I thought about actually just showing the VeggieTales video this morning. Esther, the girl who became queen, it's actually about a 40-minute video. That's about perfect in terms of the amount of time we would need. But that thought passed pretty quickly. So, actually, the story of Esther has made its way into a lot of very popular movies. Because it's such a good story. Esther is such an amazing story. I mean, it has great plot line, great character development, and yet it's true, and we see that in the Bible. And we're going to touch on some of these pretty amazing themes this morning. But if you get the chance this week, Esther's 10 chapters long, maybe take you about an hour. Take some time and just read through the story of Esther. It's pretty remarkable. Now, last week with Solomon, I kind of took the grand overview, and then we zoomed in on a few things. Now this week, I'm going a little bit different direction. I'm actually just going to kind of walk through the story of Esther today, stop along the way, point out a few things, and we'll see where that goes. So before we do that, let's go ahead and pray. God, thank you for your word. Thank you for your stories. Characters in the Old Testament, people like Esther, from whom we can learn about you and learn about ourselves. God, I pray that you would ready each of us today to hear about her, to hear about this amazing young girl, as well as the other characters in this story, God. And I pray that you would teach us about you in this process, God. I pray this in your good name. Amen. So, as the fine folks at VeggieTales have told us, Esther is the story about a girl who became queen. It's the story takes place during the reign of a king. His name is Ahasuerus, I think. I'm going to warn you, there's a lot of really hard names to pronounce in here. I actually thought about switching characters just because of the difficulty in pronouncing some of these folks' names. So King Ahasuerus is his name, and he's also known as King Xerxes, which is actually a lot easier to pronounce. And he was the king of the Persian Empire between 486 BC and 464 BC. Now, this was an absolutely huge kingdom. If you want to put that map up there. Now, this is a picture of the Persian kingdom during that time. It ranged all the way from India to Ethiopia and all the way to Greece. So this is huge. I mean, bigger than we can imagine, I think, for a lot of things now. I mean, it's just a huge kingdom that he ruled over. And his level of power and control at that time was pretty remarkable. He ruled everything. Now, chapter 1 of Esther really sets the story. It says that during the third year of his reign, the king threw a party in Susa. Susa is the capital city. You probably can't see it from where you're at, but basically, I'm actually going to go point it out. Susa's right there. So right in the middle of the kingdom, he has this thing where he puts on display for 180 days basically how awesome his kingdom is, how amazing this large kingdom is. And so he has his officials come in, and for 6 months, basically, they have this party where he celebrates how fantastic he is. And then during the final 7 days of this, they have a feast, a party, where anyone who wants to in the entire kingdom can come in. And when they come in, drinks were served from golden vessels, the couches were covered in silver and gold, the walls were all draped with cotton and linen. I mean, they really did it up. Should remind us of hearing about Solomon last week, who also really did it up, and drinking from golden vessels and so forth. His queen, Queen Vashti, also threw a similar party for the women in the kingdom at the time. Now, beginning at 1 verse 10, the book reads, "On the seventh day, when the hearts of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zathar, and Carcass," I think, "the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at." So the king has just spent 6 months kind of showing off his kingdom. Now he's been basically drinking with his friends for a period of about 7 days, and he's feeling really good. And so he says, "Hey, go get my wife, bring her in here so that we can all take a look at her. Have her bring her crown in. I want to show her off. I mean, come on, bring her on in." Vashti refused. She decided she doesn't want to come in to be shown off by her husband. And so he gets mad. The king gets mad, and what does he do? He goes and talks to his officials and says, "What am I supposed to do about this? What am I supposed to do with my wife who's not coming in and letting me show her off?" And after talking to them, he banished her from his presence. Now, if you read the story carefully, I think this is interesting. It says the king was upset, and he didn't really know how to proceed, so he went and sought counsel from other men in his kingdom. And basically what they tell him is that, "Listen up, king. This is not only bad for you that your wife is not doing what you told her to do. This is going to be bad for all of the other men in the kingdom. When they get word that your wife isn't falling into place, they're going to start seeing that happen in their marriages and in their houses as well. So you need to put her in her place right now." And so he does this. They urge him to banish her. Now, I'm thinking about myself in that situation, thinking about, okay, if I have a party at my house, you know, we're all sitting around in the backyard getting married, my wife is inside doing something else, and I grab my son, Ian, and I say, "Ian, I really want to show Mom off to all my friends. Would you go in the house and get Mom, have her come out here so we can kind of look at her, because she's pretty fantastic." And so Ian goes in the house and then comes back out and says, "You know what, Mom, she doesn't want to be ogled at. She doesn't want to be stared at. Would I be within my rights to say, well, that's it, I'm kicking her out, we're divorcing?" I mean, that seems pretty ridiculous to me. This whole story of how he gets upset because she doesn't want to be shown off not only shows kind of the brokenness, but his level of power at that time as well. Now, eventually, his anger subsides, and there are young men who attend to him, and so he's a little upset. He encourages, and these young men, they encourage the king to have young women, to have virgins brought from throughout the kingdom to him, so maybe he can find a new wife. So officials were sent kind of throughout the kingdom to find all of the best young women to be brought in. And one of these young women, who's kind of the person who this story is about, is a young woman named Esther. And Esther lived right in Susa, which is the capital city, and she didn't have parents. She lived with her cousin Mordecai, and they were there because years back the Jews had been dispersed. They had been carried away under the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And so her parents are dead. She lives with her cousin Mordecai, and they're right in Susa. Now, she's very attractive, and so she's one of them that is selected by the officials to go in front of the king, to go be placed in front of King Xerxes. I'm going to stick with Xerxes. That's just easier. And so along with a lot of other young women from the kingdom, she is placed in this harem to go before the king. And she's very popular with the harem keeper, and so he does whatever he can to take care of her. He attends to her well, makes sure she's very well taken care of, and So she's very well taken care of. But also, her cousin Mordecai also lives in town. And so he comes by pretty regularly to check on her and also see if she's taken care of. And so people are kind of focusing on her, which is a good thing for her. Now, so you understand a little bit about what's going on, the young women in the kingdom would be kept in this harem for about a year. So all these young virginal women would be kept in this harem for a period of a year, for a period of beautifying. Now, we already know that they're brought there because they're already striking. They're already amazing in some form or another, but they're kept there for another entire year to beautify them, to treat them with cosmetics and oils and whatnot, to make them apparently even more beautiful before they go into the king. Now, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, okay, when women get married nowadays, I mean, I think there's definitely a preparation time for the wedding, but I don't know how many of them spend 6 months getting their cosmetics ready. I mean, sometimes it may feel that way, but I don't think that many of them spend that long in this period of beautifying. So this is really a remarkable thing that they're spending this much time. Now, it's not clear to me that they were in the harem by choice. I suspect not. They were probably taken from their homes. But at the same time, I think they were probably treated pretty well. I suspect they were pampered, given what they needed during this year that they lived there. So each of the young women on the night with the king would leave the harem after having been beautified and go in to please the king. Now, we have a lot of young people in service right now, so we'll stick with the VeggieTales version, which I think shows them playing a board game together. Singing songs, is that what it was? Okay. That's probably not what happened. It's probably more of a PG-13 or rated R story, but we're going to stick with what we're at today. So they would go into the king, and then in the morning, they would leave the king's presence, and they would go into a second harem, and they would live out the rest of their days in this second place where all the concubines lived, and would be there for the rest of their time, and would never again go into the presence of the king unless they were specifically called by name, unless there was something special about them that they were called specifically into his presence. And so they would be in a second harem. So it'd be harem one night with the king, harem two. Now, when it was Esther's turn to go into the king, she did exactly what the harem keeper told her to do. She took nothing in except what she was told to do. And so she went in, and just like everybody else had responded to her, the king saw her and was wowed. I mean, he was really blown away by Esther. It says the king was immediately drawn to the young woman, and in 2:16 and 17, it says, "And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So this is now 4 years after he initially kicked Queen Vashti out. He chooses a new queen, this young Esther, this young Jewish woman, to be his queen. And he's apparently so happy, he throws another party, another feast, and he cuts taxes for all of the provinces. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, that'd be great if our taxes would be cut over somebody getting married, but just great. So meanwhile, in the story, her cousin Mordecai is still living in the kingdom of Susa. He's still living right in the capital city. And at the end of chapter 2, we read that he's sitting at the city gate where people are gathered, and he's sitting there, and he happens to overhear two of the eunuchs, so two of the people who attend to the king, very angry, very mad, talking about something that the king had done and their plans to kill him. And so he passes the word of this along to the queen, to Queen Esther, who then manages to get it to the king. Sure enough, they investigate. These two men had been planning this, and they end up getting hung on the gallows. They're killed for this. And this is all written down in a book, but not really mentioned again until later. And in fact, that's one of the things with the story of Esther, is you have to pay attention to the details because they tend to show up later. That's why this is such a beautifully developed story. So pay attention as we're kind of talking through some of these details, because it's going to show up later on down the line. So at this point, Esther is now the queen of Persia. Mordecai remains in Susa, and a new character enters the story. His name is Haman the Agagite. Now, apparently in Jewish tradition, when the story is read, they do rattles, right? And boo when his name is read. So Haman's the bad guy. I mean, if this was a Western, he'd be the one wearing the black cap, right? I mean, he's the bad guy in the story. And so he shows up, and he's a court official for the king, and he ends up getting promoted and promoted and promoted until he's basically right beneath the king. It says that his throne was set above all the other officials, and because of his status, people would be required to bow down before him. Not only the citizens, but even the other court officials would be required to bow down to him in his presence. Now, unlike the others who bowed down, Mordecai refused to bow down to the king. He refused to acknowledge the Persian custom and what the king had said about bowing down. And when asked why he wouldn't bow down, he apparently said again and again that he wouldn't bow down because he's a Jew. Now, when I read that, the first thing that comes to mind is story in Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Again, if you're a VeggieTales fan, that's Rack, Shack, and Benny. But this refusal to bow down before the king. And so my thought is, okay, this is Jewish custom. You don't bow down before idols. You don't give worship to anyone else. And I think there's an element of that going on here. But I think there's something else going on in this story as well. If you follow the history through, it says Haman was an Agagite. Mordecai was a Jew. They have tensions between these two people groups for a long time past. Back in the book of Exodus, there's tensions between them. We read later on that King Saul ends up defeating the Agagites. So this is a lot of tension. This is Hatfield and McCoys. This is Microsoft, Apple's not a good example. But people groups fighting against one another. They really just didn't like each other. So perhaps part of it is that he doesn't want to bow down because of his commitment to God. But maybe it's just because my family doesn't bow to that family. We don't treat them with respect. You know, some of you may have had this experience. I was thinking as I was going through this, reflecting back on when I was in high school, and there was a guy in my class. We were a day apart in birthdays. Probably approached a lot of things the same way, but if he said black, I said white. If I said up, he said down. And I think of putting myself in that circumstance, if somebody had said, you know what, you're required to bow down to him, I would have said, no way am I bowing down to this guy. And I think a lot of us have that with relational stuff where we just have tensions with certain people and this refusal to bow in their presence. And I think some of that was probably going on here. Regardless of what it was, Haman is getting madder and madder. He's getting angrier and angrier. And it says in Esther 3:5 that Haman was filled with fury. Now, it would have been well within his power to kill Mordecai for refusal to follow the king's commands, or for refusal to bow down, but that apparently wasn't enough for him. He doesn't just plan to kill Mordecai. He decides he's going to commit genocide. He's going to kill the entire race of the Jews, all the Jewish people. He's going to wipe out the whole line. And so he approaches the king and says, there's this meddlesome line of people who are refusing to comply with the customs of your kingdom. Now, as I mentioned, the Persian kingdom is massive. I mean, it's just this absolutely huge kingdom, probably made up of a lot of different people groups, most of whom are probably falling into line, but this Jewish people, Mordecai, are refusing to do so. And it says in chapter 3, 8 and 9, it says, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, so that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So Haman manages to go in and convince the king that the Jews aren't going to go along with this with the culture, go along with custom. And because of that, as a people, they shouldn't be tolerated and should be destroyed. They should just be killed off. So the king is moved by Haman's plea and probably the promise of 700 tons of gold or of silver. And so he signs off on the decree and agrees that the Jewish people should be killed off. At this point, I think it's important to stop in the story for a bit. The Jewish people have been persecuted basically since the beginning. I mean, there's a long line of persecution of the Jewish people. There is, you look at under the Egyptian rule, you look at this circumstance under King Nebuchadnezzar, certainly under the Nazis, the Jewish people have been persecuted. Time and time again, they face persecution and rise above it. And if you are a Jewish person in parts of Persia now, you're still going to be persecuted. And that's true of Christians as well. In many regions of Persia, which is the Middle East, you're going to be killed for your faith or persecuted for your faith. And so this sort of persecution continues for God's people. Even in the United States, the tolerant nation we live in, there are Christians who don't bend to cultural expectations. I don't think we're supposed to bend to many cultural expectations. And there's been a move among many to suppress religious freedom, to say that we should keep our mouths shut and not speak out. I could come up with story after story of this. Just one that I was thinking of this week. The American Psychiatric Association uses a book called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, which is basically a book that helps them to decide what things like depression and anxiety and schizophrenia and that sort of thing are. And for many of the disorders, there's what's called a religious exemption. So if you are a religious person and you're experiencing certain things, it's part of the religious custom, and so it's not considered pathological. Well, there's a move among certain psychiatrists, among certain groups, to remove that religious criteria. And they're saying basically so that they can finally eradicate religion, so that they can finally identify religion as pathological, religion as mental illness. So there's moves of this sort of thing to get rid of religion altogether. So this persecution exists for the Jews, for Christians, and we should expect that to be happening. Now in 3:13 and 14, we read that letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder all their goods. So in one day, in 127 provinces, by edict of the king, an entire race of people was to be wiped out, was to be exterminated. Naturally, Mordecai gets word of this, and he weeps bitterly. He's very upset about this. From province to province, as Jews hear about this, they mourn and they lament. They're very upset that their people are going to be killed off. And Esther hears about, she's still inside the palace, she hears about the distress of her cousin, tries to comfort him, tries to get him to put on clothes, tries to get him to come in, and he doesn't want to. He refuses to come in, and so she manages to communicate through one of her attendants and discovers what's going on. She finds out that the Jewish people are to be killed off. And through this line of events, Mordecai asks Esther to approach the king and basically offer a plea for the Jewish people. Now, Esther communicates back to Mordecai. She says, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live." So Esther is the king's wife. She's the queen. And she is even afraid of going into his presence without being called into his presence. And so she's facing a dilemma here. On the one hand, her cousin, the man who raised her, is asking her to go in and ask the king about this edict regarding the Jews. But she also knows there's a very real possibility that she could be killed. Her husband, the king, has already fired Queen Vashti. Very likely that she could be harmed or kicked out as a result of this. And so she's facing basically the conflict between death to her and death to all of her people. Two pretty terrible options. So Mordecai sends word back into her after she communicates to him in what is probably the most memorable part of the whole book of Esther. He says to her, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." I think Mordecai could be an inspirational speaker. Yeah, Esther is rightly scared to go into the presence of the king. But Mordecai basically says to her, listen, if you don't speak up, you're going to die anyway. You and your father's house, you're all going to be killed. And the Jews are going to be delivered because the Jews are delivered from stuff like this. We know historically the Jews get delivered. But you're not going to escape, so what are you going to do? He basically reminds her that she may have been placed there just for this purpose, just to go in and talk to the king about this circumstance. So reluctantly, she agrees that she should go in and talk to the king. But before doing so, she asks Mordecai and the Jewish people to fast. So for 3 days, they eat nothing as a people in readying her for going in to spend time with the king. So 3 days later, after fasting, Esther puts on her royal robes and goes in to the presence of the king. And the king sees her there and holds out the scepter to her, which again is the sign that she's allowed to approach. So far, so good for her. She approaches and touches the tip of the scepter, and he says to her, "Esther, I'll give you anything up to half of my kingdom." So he's clearly in a good mood. He's wanting to be able to respond to his wife. And so how does she respond? She says, "Well, I made dinner, and I would like you and Haman to come to dinner with me." Well, that's a pretty easy request. And so they go, and they have dinner together, these three, and they eat a good meal. After dinner, the king again asks Esther what she wants, and she invites him to a second dinner. So, "Hey, we just had dinner. Why don't you come again to dinner?" I've often wondered as I read this, why the second dinner? Why couldn't she have just put out the first time what her concerns were, what her question was? I wonder, was she really nervous? Was she putting off the inevitable? Was she trying to buy some time? I probably would have been trying to buy as much time as I could with the king. And so she puts it off and says, "Come again to dinner tomorrow night." Maybe she was just trying to put herself further into the king's good graces. Anyway, the king agrees, and he and Haman decide they'll come to dinner again the following night. Now, not surprisingly, after dinner, Haman, the evil Haman, is feeling pretty good about himself, right? He thinks pretty highly of himself. He goes and he spends time with his friends and with his family and basically brags about his kids and his job, and now even the queen really likes me because she invited me to dinner, and it's just me and the king and Esther, so I'm in really in good grades. So he's prideful. Looking back at that diagnostic and statistical manual I was telling you about, he would be what we would call a narcissist. So he thinks he's better than anybody else. He thinks that he has better skills, that he deserves more, that everything should revolve around him. And so this dinner invitation, in combination with this thought of doom for the Jews, leaves him feeling pretty giddy. And his wife and friends kind of push that further along by saying, "You know what you should do? You should have a gallows," so basically a place to hang people, "made that's 75 feet tall." He agrees, has this gallows built to hang Mordecai upon. Now, interestingly, again, I mentioned you should focus to pay attention to details. Interestingly, during the night, between the two dinners, the king can't sleep, and so he asks that the Book of Memories be read to him. And so, as the stories are being read, Mordecai's valiant act, if you remember earlier, Mordecai had passed along information to save the king. This story is recounted to the king, and he hears it, and he discovers that Mordecai's never been rewarded. And so he thinks, boy, we need to do something for Mordecai to respond to this, to respond to his honoring me in that way. And so in an interesting turn of events, the king asks Haman, hey, how would you reward somebody who deserves honor from the king? Now, as I mentioned, Haman's a narcissist. So his first thought is, well, of course it must mean me. I mean, who else would the king honor except me? I'm the one who deserves all the honor. And so he basically tells him, you know what? Put this guy on the king's horse, dress him in the king's clothing, really do it up. Basically make him like the king. The king agrees. That's a good idea. And so he passes it along that this is to be done to Mordecai. This has got to be a little humbling and probably angering for Haman. He painfully discovers how pride can go before the fall. Now, we now discover that Haman goes to dinner. They come and get him, and he goes to dinner along with the king and with Esther. And so they eat, and again, the king asks her what she would like. And as I was reading this, I kind of envisioned the king almost with a tenderness in his request, saying, hey, what is it you want me to do for you? Again, up to half of my kingdom. What is it you would like me to do? And so she's nervous, and she gathers her breath and responds and says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request, for we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. I imagine you could probably cut the tension in this room with a knife right now. The king is probably wondering, wait, what? What do you mean? Who wants to kill you? Who wants to kill your family? It's probably dawning on Haman that, oh no, this is probably me. Esther is still nervous because she doesn't know what's going to happen. And so the king demands to know who it is, and she tells him that it's the evil Mordecai who's delivered this plan. And so the king steps out of the room. Haman comes over and begs the queen for his life. He basically falls at her feet and is like, please, please, please save me. The king returns to the room, and he's groveling at her feet, and he's like, now you're going to assault my wife? In addition to this, you're going to assault my wife in my presence? And he's like, I don't know what to do with you. Thankfully, one of the attendants there is like, you know what? Haman had that gallows built. You could have him hung on that. And so, sure enough, they send him out and have him hung on the gallows that he built for Mordecai in an interesting twist or turn of events. I was just reading this morning in Proverbs. It says, the Lord tears down the house of the proud. That's what we're seeing here with Haman. Now, the story continues on for a few chapters. It wraps up with Mordecai eventually set over the house of Haman, Esther pleading for the king to overturn the edict, which he does, and how the Jews go on to destroy their enemies. And so it's, again, this grand, amazing story. So what are we to make of it as Christians today? I want to mention just a couple of things in the few minutes that we have left. The first thing that I would point out is God's sovereignty. Esther is a very unique book. There's 66 books in the Bible. It's the only one of the 66 books in the Bible that never mentions the name of God. God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther. The Bible's all about God, right? We believe God's word is inspired, and so this book, which we believe belongs there, must somehow be about God and about God's people as well. So what are we to make of the fact that there's no mention of God here? I would say this. Even though there's no specific mention of God, his fingerprints are everywhere on this story. There's evidence of his sovereignty, so in other words, his power, his control, his oversight of everything going on here. Just consider all the things that happened just at the right time. So the king has this party, gets mad at his queen, and kicks her out. That leads to the king choosing another wife. He happens to choose Esther, who happens to be a young Jewish woman. Meanwhile, Mordecai happens to overhear a plan to assassinate the king, happens to pass it along to Esther, who happens to get it to the king. When Haman gets upset with Mordecai for not bowing down, he plans to kill him and Esther, and Esther intervenes by holding these two dinners. Now, on the night between the two dinners, the king happens to be unable to sleep, happens to ask that stories be read to him, and happens to hear about Mordecai. And when Esther comes into the king's throne room, he happens to extend the golden scepter to her. All sorts of what we would think of as coincidences. These aren't coincidences. God ordains things to come to pass. And stories like this should be a good reminder to us that God is sovereign. God is involved in the story. His hand is at work. And I've talked a lot up here about the fact that we're adopting. Heather and I were talking this week. We started our adoption process for the two kids we're trying to bring home in 2010. So that's a long, long time we've been involved in this process. And yet, God's hand is involved in this process. God is not surprised by the fact that this has taken over 3 years. It may feel like he's absent. It may feel like he's not present there. But his fingerprints are all over this story, the story that we happen to be right in the middle of right now. He remains sovereign, even when he seems absent. The second thing that I would point out is that Esther bloomed where she was planted. She was a young girl, right, taken from her home, placed in the king's palace under a powerful, tyrannical king. She basically had no power at all. But she did what she could where she was at. She herself wouldn't have been able to take on Haman. She herself would not have been able to intervene in a way where she could fight back against this powerful attack on her family. What she could do was try and seek audience with the king. And that meant going before him and raising her concerns. You know, sometimes I think we get into this mindset that unless we're doing something really big or really grand, or if we're going overseas and evangelizing, that it's not worth doing. And I don't think that's right. I think we can all benefit from really seeking how do we glorify God and love others right in the middle of where we're at. Maybe it's offering comfort to a coworker. Maybe it's offering help to a neighbor. Remember what Mordecai told Esther. He told her, "And who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Who knows whether you have been placed in exactly where you need to be for exactly this season to glorify God?" I told Grace this morning that I was actually going to spend the whole morning talking about her. She's like, "Go ahead," but I am going to share one Grace story. When Grace was in second grade, she was in school, and she was evangelizing to a young Muslim boy in her class. She was blooming where she was planted. That was the environment in where she was. And so she was talking to this young man about Jesus, and the two of them would have conversations about God. And school found out about it, and they both ended up having to go through counseling as a part of that process, but because apparently you don't talk about such things. But anyhow, she was blooming where she was planted by talking about Jesus. And then moves on to the last point. Esther moved in the midst of her fear. The Jewish people were facing annihilation. It would have been not surprising if she would have decided, "You know what, I'm not going to do anything. They don't really know that I'm a Jew. King seems to like me, so something might happen to my family, but for the time being, I'm pretty safe. It's probably okay if I just sit back and don't do anything." Would have been the easier thing to do. But she didn't. She stepped out in the middle of her fear. I think we need to do that too. There are times when it's easier not to tell people about Christ. There's times when there's cultural issues taking place around us that it's easier just to keep our mouths shut on. But we need to step out in the midst of fear. Esther stepped out. We need to step out in our fearfulness and move forward, move toward people. I think we can learn a lot from this person of Esther. You know, she was placed in a circumstance she didn't choose. She faced fears that no one would ever want to face. And yet she put herself out there. She was put in a place for such a time as this, and she bloomed in exactly that spot. Let's pray. God, thank you for just the chance to learn about your servant Esther. God, I thank you for all of these stories you share with us. God, help us to remember the presence of your sovereign hand in everything that we see. God, even where your name is not mentioned, God, you remain sovereign. You remain in control. You remain in power over everything. God, help us to live for you. Help us to live sacrificially for you and for others, God. I pray that as we go out from here today that you would honor dads and help us to love our families sacrificially as well, Lord. I pray this in your good name. Amen.